Good morning. I'm Valerie Norville, Director of Publications at the United States Institute of Peace. Welcome to today's program, Rewiring the Diagram, Regional Conflict Management and Global Security, focusing on issues raised in the Institute's new book on this timely subject and available just outside for sale. The usual administrative detail. I ask you to turn off your cell phones. Thank you very much. Today's topic will be introduced by Richard Solomon, the Institute's president. Dr. Solomon is no stranger to the complicated relationship between conflict management and regional security. From 1989 to 1992, he was Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs. In that role, he negotiated the Cambodian Peace Agreement, had a leading role in the dialogue on nuclear issues between the United States and North and South Korea, helped establish APEC, and led bilateral negotiations between the U.S. and Japan, Mongolia, and Vietnam. He then served as U.S. ambassador to the Philippines, coordinating the closure of U.S. naval facilities and developing a framework for bilateral and regional security cooperation. Dr. Solomon has been the president of the Institute for more than 17 years. Among his many projects, he was prime mover behind the Institute's cross-cultural negotiation initiative. Drawing on his extensive experience negotiating the opening with China in the 70s, he authored one of the first studies in that series on Chinese negotiating behavior. He's also co-author of American Negotiating Behavior, Wheeler Dealers, Legal Eagles, Bullies, and Preachers. Dr. Solomon?
Good morning. I've got to get my staff to stop reading my bio. It sounds like an obit at this point. But this is a special treat for me to introduce this session this morning for reasons I'll spell out, both substantively and in terms of the work of the Institute of Peace. Some of you, not all of you have gray hair, but some of you who are baseball fans will know of that famous triple play threat. I think they played for the Chicago White Sox. Tinker to Evers to Chance. This was the shortstop, the second first baseman, and they had the world's record in double plays. And that's, in its own way, an analog to what we are recognizing here today, because our triple threat team, of course, is Crocker to Aull to Hampson. These colleagues have produced now 8 books that really have played a major role in rebuilding the literature on international affairs in the post-Cold War world. And so this book builds on a tremendous intellectual contribution. Indeed, they can't write anything that's shorter than what? This is 600 pages. I think if you add them all up, they stack up like this, reflecting the depth of experience and intellectual contribution that they make to the field. What is important about this book and the earlier ones they do is that they underline the fact that the world is in a period of major structural change. Since the collapse of the Cold War, we are in the midst of a series of transformations in the way the international system works, in the challenges that are before the international community. And what this book helps to do is look at one aspect of those changes and changes that are explored in some of the other volumes. I think you all know of the kinds of threats that, I'm sorry, my glasses don't focus quite at this distance. But with the end of the bipolar world, we've seen a fragmentation that, again, leads to an examination, among other things, of the role that regional structures are beginning to play in conflict management. We're fortunate that we're in a time when we don't see major international confrontations as we did live through for most of the 20th century, although there's tremendous uncertainty at the moment of what everybody's dealings with China are going to look like. Is Russia going to continue to be a secondary problem, or will the new Putin government turn out to be problematic? There are still these issues, but for the most part, the challenges we face are of a more regional or local character, weak and failed states, the challenges of dealing with ethnic and religious conflict. I think we're all well aware of these. And with these changes have come new security challenges. Nuclear proliferation now out of control, at least in the cases of North Korea, Iran. Interesting development recently, of course, in Burma that was beginning to be a problem there. Libya also. economic instability, not a military problem, but one that is, as we see again day by day as we read just the newspapers, is turning out to be an enormous challenge. In dealing with what I find one of the most interesting aspects of this new era in international affairs, and that is the mobilization of large publics. And while the book doesn't get off into this in great detail, it's another aspect of our work here, that the information revolution is truly transforming the character of both domestic politics all around the world and international affairs. I mean, that's been the driver of a lot of what's been playing out over the last year and more, to everybody's surprise, in the Muslim world. Information technology, social networking, these are making mass publics a much more powerful element in international affairs than we've ever anticipated. And how we're going to deal with the impact of all these changes is, of course, very interesting challenge. So what our authors are helping us to do is think through some of the challenges of trying to organize the way we deal with international conflict, where, again, it's a very different character and it's structured in a very different role way. Let me just say, on behalf of the Institute, what our colleagues are leading us to is a new dimension of the work of the Institute of Peace. Thus far, our efforts have been substantially, if you like, at our own initiative in an American context, even though we've been very active in certain parts of the world, Iraq, Afghanistan in particular, where we've had people on the ground, we've had offices that are helping to try to stabilize those situations. But I would see the next phase of growth of the Institute as building international networks that collaborate in conflict management, building on the experiences and the work that our colleagues have done here. Part of this is training. And one of our authors, Pamela Hall, is the provost of our Academy for International Conflict Management and Peacebuilding. And I think this institution, while it will initially focus on training the civilian capacity in our own country, over time we have the ability to reach out and build training relationships, networks in other parts of the world. So again, what we're looking at are changes that I think will enable the Institute and its charter to move on to even more interesting challenges. Finally, let me just say that we're dealing here with the A-team, not just our three authors, who, again, have produced this tremendous body of work, but the contributors to the volume, again, reflect leading intellects in the study of international affairs. And I won't, I think the bios have been passed out, I hope, so I'm not going to repeat, other than say that Richard Betts from Columbia has just published a very interesting book. I say that not having read it yet, Dick, but on American force, the American use of military power in dealing with the world. Alvaro de Soto from the City University of New York, a very seasoned diplomat who brings that on-the-ground experience and perspective to our work. Ellen Lapson is, I guess, not here. Maybe she'll be showing up later. Anyway, Ellen runs the the Stimson Center, but has the distinction of having served on the best policy planning staff at the State Department, at least the best that I've ever served on. And Chantal de Jean-Goudrat, our colleague, who was a big help in building up our fellows program, is now with SIPRI, the Stockholm Institute, and then Paul Williams from GW, who, again, we're delighted is with us today. So I think we're going to have an exceptionally interesting and important session today, and we'll be moderated by Chet Crocker. Chet, we thought, had a permanent position on the board of directors of the Institute. He was chairman of the board for 12 years, and I think altogether was almost 20 years you were on the board, irreplaceable as an intellectual force in the growth of the Institute of Peace. So, Chet, the podium is yours.
Thank you very much, Dick, for those introductory words and those kind remarks. Appreciate all that you've said. I do want to underscore the point that your support, Dick, for the intellectual roots of our field has been indispensable, and we value it highly, especially at a time when people in this field tend to talk increasingly about hearts and minds and boots on the ground and all those good things, action-oriented, operational work, which is vital. We need to be able to connect the dots so that the hearts and the boots are connected to the minds. And and that's one thing that you have played a key role in doing by supporting the intellectual work of this institution. You've also taken a word out of my mouth by recognizing a person who is not formally on the program, but that's the woman sitting to your right, Pamela All, who has been the inspiration for this book series in many respects, and without her commitment and vision to the field of education and training, I don't think this book series would ever have happened. So, Pamela, thank you very much. Dick has made my job easier by outlining some of the issues that are in rewiring regional security. I'll add just a few quick comments and then introduce our primary speakers on the panel. Typically, books about regional security focus on one region rather than the entire world's regions. This book focuses on all the major regions of the world. Secondly, typically, books of this kind are written in places like Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Palo Alto, and Washington, D.C., and New York, and so on, by people who go to meetings in Palo Alto and Boston and New York. The primary authors of the regional chapters of this book are from the regions themselves, and so we felt that that was a different perspective. We need to know how others define the security challenges that they face and how others define the responses that they will make to those challenges. So that's the unique, different aspect of the book, and one that we're very pleased to see actually appear now in print. In our concluding chapter in this volume, Fenn Hampson, Pamela All, and I make the case that there is an emerging phenomenon that we call collective conflict management, which is a spontaneous, improvised pattern of cooperation between a whole series of varying entities, whether they be international organizations, coalitions of the willing, structured alliances, non-governmental organizations, private corporations, all sorts of different kinds of entities, who get together to respond to problems based on their interests rather than on formal charters engraved somewhere in stone. We're not trying to sell something that we've invented out of whole cloth. This is what's happening in the world. We're describing a pattern that we see. We're not advocating for it. We describe a pattern that we see. We see it in counterterrorism cooperation across the Sahel in Africa. We see it in the Global Fund to fight AIDS and malaria and tuberculosis. We see it in the NATO-AU Arab League reaction and response to unrest in Libya. We see it in the struggle against trafficking in the Balkans, in efforts to mediate in Mindanao, in the pattern of interaction that led to the breakthrough on the Basque conflict. Many of today's problems go beyond the capacity of any single actor. And many of today's problems nobody wants to own by themselves. So what you're seeing is what we call collective conflict management. It's not a panacea. It has lots of issues, lots of potential weaknesses, but it's out there. And so we don't advocate necessarily that this is a transcendental change or improvement in the global capacity for conflict management. Rather, what we say is this is what's happening, and it may be the best that we're going to get for a while. You see it in terms of the Arab League's sudden emerging status when it comes to Middle Eastern questions. You see it when President Obama and the Chinese leadership try to figure out how they can dress themselves in regional clothing in order to appear to be part of the East Asian security infrastructure. Our first panel will look at some of the main global security challenges of our time. I've touched on a couple that come out of our book, but there are lots of others. And rather than give you my own view of what they are, I'm going to turn it over to our two guests who are here to give us their take. We asked Dick Betts to discuss a very modest theme, and I quote, this is what we said in our letter to Dick, the current state and future direction of international security. What is it? Who provides it, and under what circumstances? This is not an assignment we would give lightly to anybody, but Dick Betts, as you can see from his bio that you've all received, is the right candidate for the taking on that assignment. He's on the short list, everyone's short list of international security scholars, and the book that Dick, you mentioned, which is just out, includes a number of great essays that we all look forward to committing to memory. Dick, your article entitled Regaining Strategic Solvency is certainly going to be required reading, I'm sure, in many courses, like the one that you wrote back in the mid-90s called The Delusion of Impartial Intervention that I've been assigning to students for about 15 years now. So Dick will speak first about those themes. Our second speaker, we asked Alvaro de Soto to address the role and limits of international institutions, what they offer, how they are affected by changing dynamics in the global international system. For many years, one of the senior most mediators in the UN system, Alvaro brings a wealth of experience and multi-regional experience to our discussions today in Europe, in the Middle East, in South and Central America. As a special representative for the Secretary General, Alvaro knows from direct experience about the interaction between the regional and the global level of security and how global politics affects regional security mechanisms. He is in demand as an author, as an eminent peacemaker, and as a lecturer in many places, and we're very fortunate to have him with us today. Dick, I'm going to give you the floor first for about 15, 20 minutes, and then we'll turn to Alvaro. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the chance to pronounce on these cosmic questions about international security, and I can only obviously touch on a few questions that I think are important, but I think it's especially a good idea to have this book at this time because it's original and comprehensive and also not ethnocentrically American in the perspectives representatives you've indicated. And I'm reminded of a line I heard from, I believe it was Seiji Ogawa in a conference I was at in Tokyo about a decade ago, where he said that since the end of the Cold War, economy has been globalized, but security has been regionalized. And I think it's important to distinguish economic globalization from political globalization. There's a debate about whether they naturally go together or not, and I tend to be on the skeptical side of that debate and a little more attuned to, maybe one might say, the clash of civilizations instinct as opposed to the end of history approach. But anyway, I would talk about the things involved in regional and global security questions in terms of traditional concepts of security as distinct from the broader concept of human security, although they obviously can overlap in important ways. And in one sense, we're told to be reassured in that some studies have indicated that there's been a secular decline in international political violence and the incidence of war. There's a popular book just out by Steven Pinker about how war has been going away. Well, maybe, but I still can't help but notice the headlines every day about the extent to which that's not true, even if in the great scheme of things it is in some sense. And it seems to me that if we can happily look forward to the continuation of this trend, that's great. But there are two things to worry about. One is weapons of mass destruction, which mean that even if there's a low incidence of violent conflict on a large international scale, the higher intensity means that the risks and significance could be higher. And secondly, even if the frequency of war is in decline, it only takes one big outlier to spoil the party. World War II, for example, there's a story of a retiree in the British Foreign Office, an intelligence analyst who had worked from 1905 to 1950, and at his retirement ceremony when they were giving him the gold watch, he said, every year the worriers and fretters said, war is coming, war is coming. And every year I said, no, no, don't worry, it's not going to happen. And I was only wrong twice. So I think the regional focus for trying to appreciate evolving security problems is especially appropriate. It relates to both the two critical dimensions of violent conflict, interstate war and internal or civil war. Internal wars, are usually about the character of a regime, can be powerfully influenced by transnational but still regional sorts of concerns, pan-Islamic or other sorts of influences in places like the Middle East, or areas where important national groups don't respect national boundaries, like Pashtuns between Afghanistan and Pakistan, and so on. And in terms of interstate war, the question of the international structure of power and how it will evolve and affect the odds of conflict. In line with what I said a moment ago, I would argue that since the end of the Cold War, the global structure of power has been unipolar, but the regional structure of power is more often multipolar. That is, there's only one country that can operate in a serious way militarily anywhere in the world, and that towers above all others in terms of capability to deal with security problems, the United States. But that power is fractionated, diffused, committed in various areas, so that it's very hard for us to be decisive in many areas without the help of local allies and the cooperation of those in the region. So the local structure of power in various regions is going to be important, and the mechanisms for stability can vary in ways that I don't think have really gotten a lot of careful scrutiny or forethought. Regions might be stabilized by a local balance of power among the countries in the area, forming alliances or collective security mechanisms or other arrangements among themselves, or it might be stabilized by a local hegemony of a single dominant power, say Brazil in Latin America, Nigeria or South Africa in parts of that region, China in Asia, and so on, or by an external pacifier, offshore balancer, like potentially the United States. I think all of these possibilities are up for grabs, but especially for Americans, the question is important because of the issue about how large or frequent a role the United States should play in trying to stabilize unstable areas. There's also hypothetically the alternative of relying at the global level on multilateral security institutions on the United Nations or regional multilateral organizations. That's a hypothetical possibility that I think still is waiting for really reassuring examples to have us place a lot of faith. To get to maybe a few more specific sorts of problems that I think should be the focus of attention. One is, I mentioned how traditional national security issues or human security may overlap. This can come out in problems that emerge from failed states or nearly failed states and violent internal conflicts, which dominate the attention of people interested in security these days, where human security issues can turn into ones that involve the use of force or the commitment of national power, such as Somalia in 1992, or where threats to shared material resources vital for human economy or comfort may be at issue, such as declining water resources. I've been hearing for about 35 years that there's a coming war over water, and I haven't seen it yet. But just because things which are known to be potential problems don't eventuate as soon as some publicists lead us to believe doesn't mean that eventually it's not going to happen. And that's one sort of thing that could link both of these dimensions. And as someone interested in the sort of traditional hard areas of national security and in American foreign policy, I'd look to the question of which specific regions seem to be the most problematic, potentially. And at least from my point of view, these would be, unsurprisingly, the Middle East and South Asia. Combination of instabilities in those areas that make them the focus of concern. There are other areas where instability may be more pervasive or constant, such as much of Africa, but where I think it's at least less likely to raise questions about escalation of local conflicts to much larger ones. And even though most political violence and concern about security since the end of the Cold War has emerged in what we used to call the Third World, in unstable or poorer societies, I think still the biggest potential threats to security that deserve the most concern are the possible development of causes of war between great powers, interstate war among great powers. Now, that's now in remission for over half a century. And in the view of some, for various reasons, the idea of war between great powers seems permanently outmoded. I hope all of the arguments for why that's true turn out to be valid, but I think there are reasons to not place faith in that trend. One is the possibility of the escalation of conflicts among medium powers in an age of weapons of mass destruction, especially nuclear weapons. Conflicts between medium powers that might earlier have been handled or contained without undue disorder among the more dominant powers, I think, will be much less predictable in their effects if they involve weapons of mass destruction. And we've become entirely too accustomed to the assumption that weapons of mass destruction can exist and be handled by various countries in mutual deterrent relationships without ever being used again, even though nuclear weapons are now very, very old military technology. They're, what, 60, going on 67 years old. And faith in the ability to prevent the actual use for military political purposes of any weapon indefinitely, I think, is risky. So all of the issues associated with nuclear proliferation are going to obviously remain near the top of the agenda, and these are increasingly issues related to particular regions other than the ones where historically they were most prominent. We don't pay anywhere near as much attention anymore to arms control negotiations between the United States and Russia, for example, as we do to the question of nuclear weapons in Iran or North Korea or potentially other places if regional security equations degenerate. And secondly, the major question about the potential for war among great powers is one I hesitate to say anything about with Richard Solomon sitting in the front row, but that's the question of the future of Chinese power and the reaction to it in the West, especially by the United States. This seems to me an open question. I don't foresee any natural or inevitable trend either towards peaceful accommodation or towards violent conflict. It seems to me it's very easy to see scenarios where either one could come out of the evolution of present trends. A peaceful arrangement, one that's assumed by many, especially in the business community or those who pay attention to economic issues, to be the natural one, that it would be foolish for either side to interfere with, involving essentially accommodation or condominium of some sort as China becomes a superpower, is entirely possible. And, of course, it's not inevitable that China will become a superpower. Its rapid rise could be derailed, but the only reasonable assumption is that it's probable that it will before long. But it doesn't seem to me that that's necessarily the natural default option. If you worry about, as international relations theorists of certain stripes do, the problem of hegemonic transition, that is, as American primacy erodes and bipolarity emerges with a Chinese superpower, then the odds that this can be accomplished peacefully don't look overwhelming in terms of the historic record. So while that can be avoided, I think it will not be something that is avoided naturally, but that it will take work diplomatically to avoid. And personally, I think, may take some decisions in the United States about the rightful prerogatives of other countries that we have been accustomed to not assuming. So it's no surprise, I think, that China is at the top of the agenda for dealing with security issues over time. But that's, I think, just one reason that despite the possible secular decline in war and international violence, there's still plenty to worry about in the integration of local security concerns with a global order and the role of the United States.
Thank you, Dick. I think we'll go directly to Alvaro, and then we'll, if there is time on the program, we'll have some chance for Q&A. So, Alvaro, over to you.
Thank you very much, Chet, and thank you also, Dick, for your kind words. I'm very pleased to be associated with this, as well as one or two other projects of the A-team of editors who produced yet another hefty volume in more ways than one, of course. Now, the question of rewiring regional security in a fragmented world, given the preeminent role of the UN under the Charter, one might expect, I certainly would have expected, that if rewiring was to be done, it should have started there at the top. And, of course, what the book, what comes out from reading the book is that that is not what has happened. And my first reaction was that there really must be a better way of doing things. But this is the way things are happening, and I don't disagree with the analysis of most of the authors and with that of the editors. Well, we'll deal with some aspects a little bit later on. But you'll understand that given that the UN has been my oyster both as a diplomat and as a secretary of officials for most of my life, I'll be speaking from that perspective. And try to touch, to begin with, a little bit briefly about how the three secretaries general with whom I worked saw the evolution of conflict management and security. I joined the UN with Javier Pérez de Cuellar, the UN's fifth secretary general, who sort of presided over the transition from the period of marginalization and stagnation of the Cold War through to the explosion of peacemaking that occurred, either led by the UN directly or within the framework of the UN, which was possibly the most fruitful period of peacemaking to date, certainly in the 20th century. Now, when the Cold War drew to an end, the collegiality between the five permanent members of the Security Council was recovered, and it allowed for the first Security Council meeting ever at the level of heads of government, the first Security Council summit. And it took place in the wake of this rather successful peacemaking period, and there was a whiff of hubris in the air, and also in the statement that they approved, in which they asked the incoming Secretary General, Mr. Boutros Ghali, to, at this, on the crest of this wave, to present his recommendations on how it would be possible to improve the capacity of the UN in the fields of preventive diplomacy, peacemaking, and peacekeeping. Now, Mr. Boutros Ghali is remembered more because of the sort of the rather baleful arc of his the denouement of his time in office. It was his misfortune to be Secretary General as the UN wandered into the minefields of Bosnia and Somalia and Rwanda, emerging as the sort of the whipping boy du jour. But I suspect that future scholars will credit Mr. Boutros Ghali with, who was primarily an academic rather than a Secretary General plucked from the ranks of diplomats, for certain conceptual insights, even breakthroughs, I would discover. Now, he, as his first trip abroad as Secretary General, he came to Mexico. He went to Mexico for the signature of the El Salvador Peace Accords, which were initialed at midnight on the last day of his office by Pérez de Cuellar. And he was inspired by that to identify what he saw as a new field of endeavor for the United Nations, and which was consisted of the complex set of tasks that had been undertaken as part of the El Salvador peace accords, and which involved not only the traditional demobilization, disarmament of combatants, reintegration into society, but also a number of institutional reforms designed to ensure that there would be ways to solve future such disputes as had led them into a 12-year war. It contained elements of peacekeeping, there were elements of preventive diplomacy, some continuing peacemaking, but he put them all together and he saw in them a new task, a new field of endeavor consisting, which he called post-conflict peace building. Now, whose purpose was to ensure that once the guns have fallen silent, they won't be picked up and fired again. There would be ways to solve future such disputes. Institutions and avenues should be created or reformed. The armed forces should be brought under the authority of civilian government. There should be a monopoly of force in a new and modernly conceived democratic civilian police force, a proper judiciary, and so on and so forth. Now, he had the foresight to see that future mediators in internal conflict, which the UN had done for the first time in El Salvador, would actually, in the course of negotiation, be asking all sorts of searching questions so that as to identify what it is that led them to war and what the negotiators should be building into peace accords in order to ensure that these mechanisms and institutions would be put in place. This posed a rather large new challenge for the UN in the sense that it would involve it in a much deeper and more intrusive and prolonged over time way to ensure that armies which couldn't really be totally separated, as they can be in an after an international conflict, but which had to coexist, and you had to have the mechanisms for coexistence. And also he had the insight to see that the bulk of future work of the UN in the post-Cold War era would likely be in internal conflict rather than international one. And post-conflict peace building is not, of course, a name that trips lightly off the tongue. It's not the kind of slogan that you would use to launch 1,000 ships. But it did launch 1,000 bureaucrats in various agencies and programs in search of turf, hardly surprising. Now, in the report that he produced to the Security Council at their request on how to enhance the capacity of the UN, he devoted an entire chapter on the same level as peacemaking, preventive diplomacy, and peacekeeping to what he called post-conflict peacebuilding. Now, he should be given credit at least for these conceptual breakthroughs. They weren't properly followed up either by him or by the membership of the organization until 15 or 16 years later. In the 2005 summit, while Kofi Annan was Secretary General, where they decided, well, you guessed it, to throw a committee at it, the Peace Building Commission, which to my mind might have the effect over the years of deflecting the Security Council from its responsibilities, because if the purpose of post-conflict peace building is to ensure the non-recurrence of conflict, is it not inherently, intrinsically, about the maintenance of international peace and security, for which is the primary mission of the Security Council? Now, Boutros Ghali actually saw from very early on that the international community found itself on the cusp of a very important change in world affairs. He used to compare it, and he did so in various speeches. He compared it to the end of the Napoleonic Wars, to the end of World War I and World War II, noting that each of these events were followed by major conferences which had the purpose of essentially restructuring world order. Congress of Vienna, 1815, Versailles, 1919, San Francisco, and all the preparations leading up to it in 1945. But that no one was going about trying to organize the same thing at the end of the Cold War. What he was suggesting, without, of course, giving it that name, was what are we going to do about rewiring the order? Despite the momentousness of the end of the Cold War, said Boutros-Ghali, no effort was being made to see whether the right institutional framework for managing conflict, to use the words of the editors, was in place or needed to be put in place. According to Boutros-Ghali, the question was a transition towards what? Where are we going? And he kept asking this question of the membership. What do you want to do with this organization? But the membership seemed to be more interested in pursuing the Rubik's Cube of Security Council reform rather than a reflection on the direction in which they wanted to take the organization. Now, Kofi Annan and his successor had his own crosses to bear, not least of which was NATO's Kosovo operation in the spring of 1999, which raised some rather major questions. It was not, of course, the first time that members of the United Nations had taken it upon themselves to take action without Security Council authorization, and certainly not under the self-defense rule. The new element here was that reliable UN Charter stalwarts, such as the Scandinavians, also supported the action, and we were therefore entering new territory. And in a speech that he delivered to the General Assembly in September of 1999, he threw a challenge to the membership to essentially make up its mind, because you had on the one side the question of the legitimacy of an action taken by a regional or authorized organization without a UN mandate, and on the other, that of systematic violations of human rights that had to be addressed. Now, I want to talk about the trend that has been detected by the editors to this book, and I will do so as briefly as possible. It's the collective conflict management that Chet spoke of in his introductory remark. I have to say that this raises a lot of flags of concern. Chet recognizes my reaction, and I'm sure he was fully expecting it. It does ring some alarm bells. He has, of course, introduced a number of caveats to this concept. He has made very clear in his statement that you're not necessarily advocating this as something good, but it is something that is happening. I think it is alarming because of some of the reasons that are put by him in the concluding chapter of the book, including the question of the issues of orchestration that it raises. There are certain areas, for instance, the piracy phenomenon in the Indian Ocean, that perhaps require such an approach. But when we're talking about mediation to end a war in which you have readily identifiable players, it is an altogether different matter. And here I think that it is something that should be looked at very carefully. Because it could detract from the need for a mediation to have a clear leadership and clear strategy, and that all should fall behind it and unify behind it. The idea of collective mediation is something that strikes me as almost a contradiction in terms. If mediatees, even if they're not good at anything else, are usually very good at playing one mediator or one would-be mediator off against another. So that does not serve the purposes. The more is not merrier. It is not necessarily a good thing at all. In fact, I think that collective mediation, I mean, there are additions that actually subtract, if not detract. Now, Chet did say this is not a panacea, but there is a problem, which Chet has alluded to in a separate article which he published recently, and it is the proliferation of would-be mediators. Mediation is low-tech work, and it is very tempting politically, including for would-be leaders, to jump in. I could talk to you about at great length about what my first boss at the United Nations, Mr. Pérez de Cuellar, thought about the subject. His own attitude was, if someone else is doing it, well, let them do it. I'll wait my turn, but I will not interfere with an ongoing job. Now, if this has happened, if it is indeed happening, it is as a result of omissions and failings at the top, I would argue. Omissions which should be repaired. And I hope that one of the effects of the publication of this book will be to ring a few alarm bells and to see whether, I mean, obviously you cannot in this field of work impose rules or create law on who is going to get involved in a negotiation. Nobody's going to accept that there should be a single authority or clearinghouse deciding who is going to be in charge or not. But some understandings, some code of conduct, some guidelines, something to put our house in order. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Alvaro. We have a couple of very different perspectives on the world that we're entering, and I think it's interesting to focus a little bit of attention on the very different perspectives that we've had. So we have a few minutes for conversation. I'm just going to quickly sum up the ingredients that we're hearing about the evolving international security environment. I talked in my remarks about emerging regionalism, that is the self-assertion of regional actors to control their own destinies and shape their own destinies through their own institutions, which is part of what's in the book that we're talking about. Secondly, this question of spontaneous, ad hoc, improvised, collective conflict management, which sort of got Alvaro's attention, and for good reason, because it does raise questions of who's in charge and leadership and how do you coordinate and how do you network laterally and how do you borrow leverage without losing control. And then there's the other issues, which I'll quickly summarize: the spread of destabilizing technologies, the question of power transition, which Dick said a good bit about, the issue of imperial overstretch, which our new chairman of the Joint Chiefs spoke eloquently about in his interview with the FT that appeared this morning. And that issue of imperial overstretch is not only in terms of the United States, but it's also affects the United Nations, which has had its own experience with imperial overstretch. Then there's the question of hollowing out of states as a result of the activity of criminal business enterprises, which is another phenomenon of the world that we live in. And the final one that I would stress is the awakening of
previously somnolent societies. The awakening phenomenon that Zbigniew Brzezinski identified so many years ago, which is now very much part of the world that we live in. This is a very heady menu of challenges for international and regional security. So having summarized what I've heard from my colleagues up here, what we have in our book and a few other elements that Dick Solomon introduced, let me open the floor and see if people have questions from the audience. Bill?
Do you have microphones?
Yeah. I can do it out loud. So I'll borrow.
We need it for the camera. Yeah, we need it for the microphone for the recording.
Yeah. Video. Right.
When you use the Milton Leitenberg. Yes, Milton Leitenberg, Center International Security Studies, University of Maryland. When you use the phrase omissions at the top, I don't know if that's what you meant, but I assume you meant the UN Security Council and particularly the P5. Now, if we go back to Cambodia before UNTAC, you had the positions of both the United States and China, oddly enough, in support of the Khmer Rouge. If you look at Iraq, Russia, China, and France spent 4 years doing their best to undo UNSCOM. In the Kosovo situation, you had Russia and China. This is what has led to what Ivo Dalder and some others call the coalitions of the willing, which is, in a sense, the regional mediators. You, of course, must know about the contact group in terms of the Mideast and Israel. If you feel that you have to have changes with the emissions at the top, you're obligated to say how you're going to get members of the P5 to stop behaving the way they do in the Security Council.
Well, you're right, of course, that the problem has to be addressed by those who have the biggest role in allowing things to occur the way they are occurring. A lot of it has to do with not just the attitude of permanent members of the Security Council, but also how the Secretary General himself is allowed to do his work, and also with, I go even further, how Secretaries General are chosen, which is something that Perhaps the members of the Security Council, particularly the permanent members, who are, because they're always there and because they have a veto, should be turning their attention to, and that they should perhaps be a little bit more proactive in how they choose them, because it has a lot to do, it has a bearing on not just the quality, but also and the credentials, but also the temperament of the Secretaries General that are chosen and their behavior in office, which all members of the United Nations should be able to see as being in the interest of the principles of the Charter rather than those of one or another member of the United Nations or of the Security Council, no matter how powerful he may be. There's no question that this needs, that you would have to have this kind of problem addressed at the highest level. But right now, as evidenced by this book, it is what is happening has sort of drifted into place. Who is in charge? Indeed, there doesn't seem to be anybody at the wheel. There doesn't seem to be any adult supervision.
Uh, Yes, sir. And then I'll come to you, Chateau.
My name is Dick Rosen. I'm with the Council for a Community of Democracies. I'd like to ask a question which links Ambassador Solomon's question regarding the role of civil society and international public opinion, the kind of thing that's reacting in the Middle East at the present time and the revolutions taking place there or the uprisings taking place there, with what Professor DeSoto said about the need for some kind of democratic control of the military after conflict, which might be allowed, which might enable that conflict to take a peaceful rather than a war trend. It seems to me that this community, which was established by 100-and-some nations back in 2000, linking civil society with a non-governmental arm of that community, with the governments, you have a force for dealing with this democratization process, which is very important to security, as defined by Professor DeSoto. And my question is, how does that organization fit into this rewiring that he and the other members of the panel are talking about?
Perhaps we might take several questions. I'm conscious of the time, and I want to be sure people who have questions get a chance to pose them. So, Chantal, if you would go next.
Thank you. Chantal, outside of CIPRI, the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. Abaro, you said, you know, I think this phenomenon of CCM is extremely alarming. And I think, indeed, this is not a good tendency or trend for established organizations like the UN or for organizations like NATO, for that matter. I'll come back to it later. But it seems to me that, because in a way it's sort of multilateralism à la carte, but it seems to me that the current president of the United States also seems to think that this is an alarming trend. And particularly when you look at his last trip in Asia, where he seems to be bolstering alliance support in that region. And so I'd like to get your comments and maybe comments of the editors as well. Thanks.
Thank you. Other questions? Michael Lund,
U.S. Institute of Peace now, as a fellow. Well, this is just, it's hard to ask a question about the book without having read it, but picking up on what has been suggested as to the thrust of it, I'm just wondering, are we talking here simply about a process of trial and error? Of sort of the residue that sort of accumulates eventually when crises in various areas develop. And thus, you know, at some point, somebody picks up the ball because the pinch is hurting, as against something that's you say this is a spontaneous, you're noting a spontaneous trend of spontaneous action by several kinds of actors. And you're sort of making something out of that, as if this is sort of a significant trend. But is it possible that we're just talking about the residue that eventually comes into place to deal with the whole variety of issues on the part of the people who are particularly concerned?
Thank you. Any others? I'm going to pose one for Dick Betts, and then I'm going to turn over to Dick Betts and Alvaro for any concluding remarks. It does seem to me, and Fenn Hampson will be moderating the second panel and will have some views on all of these questions as well. It does seem to me that there's a very interesting irony in the fact that increasingly regional organizations and institutions assert a gatekeeper right to control the use of force in their regions. But they don't have the force themselves. They can borrow it. They can be empowered to develop it, as AFRICOM is doing in Africa, for example. But they don't have the force themselves. The Arab League can appeal to NATO and the UN, but the Arab League can't do much without imported coercive capacity. So there's an irony here, and I'd be interested in your views of this, Dick, particularly, about the growing assertion of a control of the gate the legitimacy factor, which makes it almost impossible for powerful actors from outside of regions to do anything unless they're invited to do so, at the very same time when their dependence on outside coercive authority is probably as high as it's ever been. So that's a question that I would put onto the list. Were there any others that I didn't get to? Yes, one more.
I'll be very brief. I'm Rob Dubois. I'm with the DepSecDef's Senior Integration Group. And my question that came up while we're talking about these societies is that in every society, there's a small or large presence of homegrown, local, grassroots advocacy for stability in their nation. We have it in America. We have it in Iraq, in a lot of smaller countries. Is an untapped resource by the directors of the peace movement at the administrative level? Is that something that could be harvested? Like 5 years ago, nobody would have comprehended the power of Twitter. So are the little people movements something that can be tapped into?
Thank you.
On the first question about civil society, public opinion, control of the military, one of the main problems, it seems to me, is the question of whatever political institutions of any sort there are to channel and integrate the popular uprisings that we've seen. There are, in some of these countries, very few genuine political institutions, and the dominance of the military is in part a reflection of that weakness of institutions, and the Arab Spring, the uprisings themselves, too, are, I think, a reflection of the absence of those institutions. So it's a difficult transition from this sort of welling up from below and putting the results into government. Also, it's very important, I think, to distinguish between democratization, undefined, and liberal democratization. When most of us in the United States talk about democracy, half the time or more, we're really talking about liberal democracy, liberalism, as opposed to simple majoritarian democracy, which can be quite threatening to minorities and not necessarily leading to the sorts of sweetness and light that we tend to assume go with democracy. So I think that dual problem of extracting a liberal impulse from the democratization movements and of finding a way to institutionalize it without having the military co-opt or attempt to control it is one I don't think we've had any uniform solution offered for. The question about whether we have to just do things by trial and error, if we're talking about the ability of outside powers in regions, say the United States, to influence things, I don't think there's a reliable formula that can be applied, because any formula is likely to suggest either too much or too little commitment by the outside power to action and to a role in resolving problems. If it's a formula for great activism, the problem immediately emerges of overload. There are just too many regional problems, too many disorders, too many costly potential interventions to undertake. But at the same time, just because there are too many doesn't mean that they shouldn't be done sometimes when the balance between costs and benefits is appropriate. But it's hard to think of a formula that tells you when that balance is right. It tends to be intuitive. So the problem of selection of involvement seems to me one that we haven't solved yet either. On Chet's question, I think potentially, while this is an ironic situation, it may be a good one in the sense that there can be an identity of interest between local gatekeepers, as you put it, who want to assert their natural rights to play a role despite their inability to do it effectively, and the interests of outside powers like the United States to help things along without taking on the role themselves. So I think Americans generally would prefer to pay the African Union or others to undertake some of these missions than to pay ourselves to do it. Although it's a practical political matter, I don't know that that sort of funding is going to be easy to make popular. But in principle, that makes sense as long as there is a reasonable identity of interest between the local gatekeepers and the outside sponsors, as long as we don't have cross purposes in mind. So it may be ironic, but I think it's potentially more an opportunity than a problem.
Thank you. Alvaro?
Thank you, Chet. There were a couple of questions. There was one about the community of democracies and its role in affairs. Now, I note that the community of democracies was created almost a dozen years ago, and that, let's say, the development or the spread of democracy had not reached the point, or democracy in the sense of elections, at least, as Professor Betts was saying, had not reached the point where it has reached now. I don't think it was ever meant to be more than a community in the sense of a gathering of like-minded states in the field on this particular issue, but it didn't. It was not the idea behind it that it should be operational in any sense, and it certainly wouldn't have the kind of legitimacy that the United Nations or other organizations would have. Chantal is absolutely right on her point regarding the multilateralism à la carte. What I'm sure she would agree, as perhaps others, that there is something else that gets lost when the fragmentation occurs in this sort of stealthy way, which is that the efforts toward the development of international standards, the efforts to resist relativization of concepts and values such as human rights, they sort of get lost in all of this. You allude to that in the book, in the concluding chapter. I don't think that this is a point that can be overemphasized.
Well, thank you all very much. I think we have time for a short coffee break, and then we will ask Fenn and Ellen and Paul and Chantal to join the panel up here, and we will retire to the back of the room. Thank you, Dave. Thank you very much.
Okay, if we could get started again, everybody. You've heard enough from me already. I'm just going to say a quick word about the moderator of our next panel, who is our co-author, co-editor in the series that Dick Solomon waxed eloquently about at the beginning, and that's Fenn Osler-Hampson, who is the Chancellor's Professor and Director of the Norman Patterson School of International Affairs at Carleton University in Ottawa, and has been our partner in crime for the past 16, 17 years in the production of these volumes, and is an inspiration to Pamela and me as we define the scope and the reach of different book projects. Fenn is also the author, he didn't ask me to do this, but he's the author of a new book, which is called The Global Power of Talk, and it will be coming out next week. So with that little plug, Fenn, over to you.
Thanks very much, Chet. And our panel is going to look at the topic of regional security, short circuits or new networks. And we have three terrific panelists to lead our discussion. Chantal Dejong-Udrat, who is currently the executive director of the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute office here in Washington. Before joining SIPRI, she was Associate Vice President at USIP and has held a number of appointments at Georgetown, the Paul Nitzis School at Johns Hopkins, and she is one of the leading experts in this town on transatlantic relations and global security issues, and contributed a very good chapter to the book on transatlantic relations. Ellen Leibson is president and CEO of the Stimson Center, and she also directs the Southwest Asia Project, which focuses on security issues in the Gulf region. Ellen has had a very distinguished career in government, as you can see from her bio, some 25 years of public service, and has had positions that have included the Vice Chair of the National Intelligence Council and Special Assistant to the U.S. Permanent Representative to the United Nations. And last, but by no means least, Paul Williams, who is a professor of international affairs at George Washington University. He also is a contributor to the volume and wrote a superb chapter on the politics of regional organizations in sub-Saharan Africa with a co-author from the region. He has taught at Aberystwyth, Birmingham, Warwick, Georgetown University, and Australia. Before I turn to our panelists, I'd just like to make a few comments. My first comment is that you can always judge a book by its cover. When I first saw the cover of this volume, my immediate reaction was that these were all the places that Chet Crocker had visited or traveled to when he was Assistant Secretary of State. He assured me it wasn't, and then I said, well, is it the flight plan for Emirates Airlines? This is really taking rewiring too literally. I think the cover does actually have an important message, and it's not the message that security, as Dick Betts said in his own comments, is globalized. In fact, our book makes the opposite point. Security is increasingly viewed in divisible terms, and as you jump down Alice's rabbit hole and start to look at the world from a bottoms-up perspective, it looks very different from the way it looks here in Washington, and I hasten to add Ottawa, that other great capital, to the north. But what's interesting is that even though from a regional perspective, and it's quite well documented even in some public opinion data that is shared in the book, that depending on which region you are, how you view the matrix of security threats is going to be quite different. What's also quite clear is that in each one of the regions, there is a great appreciation of the fact that whether it's soft or hard security challenges, they don't respect the boundaries either of the nation state or the region itself. If you take an issue like the trafficking of drugs in the Western Hemisphere, which affects the Caribbean, it affects Central America, it affects South America, but it also has a very important transatlantic dimension in the sense that some of the important trade routes are in sub-Saharan Africa, and it also includes Europe. So these are actually the drug trafficking flight plans that you see on the volume, and I think that's part of the paradox here is that, you know, yes, in terms of both security management and perceptions of security, it's become much more localized. And, you know, that is one of the effects of the end of the Cold War. But in many ways, the problems do have, whether they're the soft security problems or, for that matter, hard security problems like nuclear nonproliferation, they have a critical transnational, transregional dimension to them. And I think part of the reason you see the CCM, or collective conflict management response that Chuck talked about, is that there is a recognition at both the global and the local level that these problems can't be handled by themselves. Second important point I would make is that as we talk about regional capacities for collective action, the book makes a very strong point in its different chapters, and I'm sure we're going to hear it from our authors, is that the capacities for collective action at regional and sub-regional levels do vary very enormously from region to region. And those capacities are clearly affected by the depth and salience of regional integration, and that includes the economic dimension. They're affected by the capacity of local institutions to actually deliver on security management. There's tremendous variation across regions in terms of capacities for regional conflict management. Norms in the region. Some regions have strong norms for cooperation, but maybe rather under-institutionalized. That's certainly true of the Asia-Pacific region, although it is increasingly becoming institutionalized, as we all know. And what the book also refers to as the sovereignty addiction. Sovereignty is not dead. And where it lives and breathes with a vengeance is in many of the regions that that are discussed in this book. There are also different regional capacities or appetites, you might say, for collaboration with external actors. One of the things that's quite striking is that the African Union and other sub-regional entities in sub-Saharan Africa are quite willing to cooperate with the UN and other external actors, particularly on the capacity side, but right down to joint operations. That's not true in other regions, and so there are, in some cases, quite high barriers to entry to CCM ventures. There are many caveats in the book. We're not trying to sell you something. CCM is, it's a description of how the world is changing. We try to explain why it has emerged, but we're not trying to sell you a bill of goods here. I almost would say that this is a book of caveats. Carefully underlined ones, and that's what happens when you assemble the kind of multitude that we have in this venture. So I would like to turn to Ellen first, and we'll just go down the row.
Well, thanks very much, Fenn. I've really enjoyed my very recent association with some of the new ideas, the fresh thinking in this book. I was not one of the contributing authors. There were actually three chapters on the Middle East, and I think it will... That in and of itself explains part of the problem that I've been asked to address. One was written by an Anglo-Iranian, looked at the whole regional system. One was looked at the particular security perspectives and culture of Israel. And a third looked at the Arab world. So by definition, we already see that sub-regionalization or a fragmented approach to the Middle East is sometimes called for. But I think you would all accuse me of exaggerating if I said, gee, the Middle East and security, we got a few little extra problems these days than we had not had in the past. So really the big security questions about the Middle East are all kind of balls bouncing in the air right now, and there's a lot up for grabs. We don't know where they're all going to settle and whether countries are going to find new security equilibriums or whether we're going to face a decade or more of a new and different kind of instability in the Middle East. But what we know is that, and we have others have written about in the past, and I wrote recently on, is that we've always had this uneven distribution of security goods in the Middle East. We have countries that are surplus security, just like oil and wealth. There are countries that are security surplus countries and countries that are security deficit countries. So the international community most often engages with the countries that have security shortfalls. Lebanon, Palestine, Iraq would be the recent examples where the role of external actors in particular is important in trying to address some of those security deficits. But the region as a whole and the crisis and opportunity that we've seen in the Arab revolts really represents the crash of the security surplus system and perhaps the beginning of the end of a culture in which regimes invested hugely in security for themselves, not necessarily for their societies, and certainly not for the region, and that perhaps this age is ending, this period of authoritarianism where security was really the purview of undemocratically chosen regimes that did not address at all the security of their own societies and sometimes even of their own territory. So we're perhaps moving from a period of this Goldilocks problem where the porridge is always too hot or too cold but never quite right to hopefully the emergence of a new security culture, at least in those countries that are in transition. So we now have, if we include Iraq, we have the fall of at least four authoritarians, and the number may go up with Syria fairly soon. Basma Kodmani ends her very compelling chapter that was very strong conceptually, and even though it was written before the revolts, I think it has a lot of very useful thinking in it, that, you know, over time these political transitions will create an environment for new security cultures to emerge, not only more civilian control of security forces, more democratic practices, greater attention to the security interests of the society as a whole, but hopefully a greater willingness of countries to cooperate, coordinate, share information, whatever may be the requirements, to enhance regional security. I do think that right now the region is facing a number of very acute security dilemmas. Syria is certainly top of the list, where we've had this, and I'll get to institutions in a bit, but I thought I'd start with just the broad brush picture of the security dilemmas that are facing the region. The regional states have now come to the conclusion that the status quo in Syria that for many decades was tolerated without question, and there was in fact a vested interest in sustaining the authoritarian system of the Assad regime, that the Arab states have now virtually all collectively and individually decided that this situation is untenable, and they may be on the cusp of determining whether some extra push to promote change in Syria will be called for. And that would be quite extraordinary for the Arab world collectively to have decided to participate in regime change. In theory, they did it to get Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait. They did participate in that coalition. But you'll recall that that coalition stopped short of regime change. It took another decade for the United States alone to determine that regime change was required, and obviously a very, very controversial and very costly decision it was. So, but I see a number of, you know, new and unresolved, and really we don't even know how to scale some of the security problems that are currently facing the region. If Gaddafi had not been found and fallen so that the international community could embrace the completion of the transition in Libya, we would likely have seen chaos in Libya spill over the borders of Tunisia, Egypt, Chad, et cetera. We were already seeing pressures, both Libyans and non-Libyan workers in Libya, creating stress on various borders, refugee problems, et cetera, food security problems. So we are seeing, you know, short-term tensions among the countries that are changing and not changing, restless citizens in the countries that are in transition that are not yet convinced that the people at the top have embraced change fully enough. That's certainly the Egypt story. But a great uncertainty about who's up and who's down, and a shaking up of the power system, the earlier equilibrium among Arab powers. So that takes me to a second theme that comes through in this book, and I particularly enjoyed the chapter on culture. Culture and identity, I think that very compelling in the Middle East, and these arrows point in different directions. On the one hand, the Arab world is united by language, to a large majority by religion, by the colonial history, et cetera, and there's a great assumption that there are shared histories, shared interests, shared identities across the Arab world. The reality, of course, is that newly independent countries that have been independent in some cases only for, you know, 40 or 60 years are still very, very protective of their sovereignty and are increasingly proud of being able to tell distinct national histories and national narratives about the local identity, the local politics, the local culture. So we have both the tensions of sovereign states that are nominally united by these shared cultural and identity factors, but in reality, nation states that are trying to prove their distinctness. In addition, the second split in the region is between the oil-rich, demographically relatively small countries of the Gulf and the countries of the Mediterranean, which are demographically large, economically less prosperous. So we have, you know, a Euro-Med Arab culture, and we have a desert and oil Arab culture, if you will. In the past, we used to think that the desert was the sort of backward part, but certainly in the last generation, the Gulf countries have proven to be very cosmopolitan, much more integrated globally than the Mediterranean countries, and very, very dynamic players, and really learning to be global actors. If we look at the way that the United Arab Emirates can contribute to peacekeeping forces, et cetera, we see significant change in the behavior of the Gulf states vis-a-vis global security. So these culture and identity issues are fascinating, and but quite both centripetal and centrifugal forces in the region. A third set of issues that's really the broad theme of the book about networks and integration. I don't think the Arab world embraces, at least, you know, intellectual and power elites do not embrace the idea that networks is the new way to go. It does not come naturally to them. They are very controlling of information flows, although the governments are increasingly losing control. Obviously, the rising new political actors in the region, the Tahrir Square activists and others, deeply believe in networks. So we have a generational shift and the beginning of greater receptivity to thinking about communication and power and decision-making in a networked way. But there will be a lot of undertow of resistance on the part of residual elites and certainly the countries that have not changed and are very proud that they have not changed. The continued resistance to thinking about networks, I think, will continue. We also have a region in which integration has failed many times. We have a lot of lip service to the Arab Maghreb Union, the Arab Cooperation Council, et cetera, and really the only regional. But I think this may be, again, just like Basma argued, that maybe a new security culture will emerge from the countries that are changing, maybe a new attitude towards economic integration or, you know, just pragmatic cooperation will come out of the countries at least. The continuum of Tunisia, Libya, Egypt, I think, could be a new zone of potential integration. Let me move on to regional institutions. I'm feeling that there's now a great paradox that we had long believed, and you can take other regions of the world, but certainly the Middle East, that these regional institutions were moribund, they were obsolete, they were very much handicapped by the requirement of consensus, decision-making, et cetera. But in a very strange way, in the last year, I think we have to be very fair and open-minded about, is the Arab League kind of reinventing itself in a very important and interesting way? Chet already mentioned the Libya operation and the decision of the Arab League to endorse, and I thought what you were describing is in fact a very positive phenomenon in a way, that the Arab League got its act together. They have never had an army. They've never thought of themselves as having any kind of direct security capacity. But their enabling of NATO and their request and desire to be in coalition with NATO was quite a remarkable thing. I want to keep the question open and continue to watch whether the Arab League has a new lease on life. Their expulsion of Syria, one of the core Arab nationalist founding members of the Arab League, was again a rather extraordinary thing. And if they are inching along towards a request for some kind of international intervention to push Assad out of power, that will truly be unprecedented and something that all of us Middle East experts will be scratching our heads and studying for quite some time. Let me turn to the very last point about conflict management. I'm kind of taken with the idea because I think it does resonate. The informality of it does resonate in experiences that we've seen in the Middle East over the last few years. And Basma identifies different informal mechanisms of how the region helps each other in to sort of get out of predicaments they're in. Money, religion, tribes. There's lots of informal channels and mechanisms that can be used in the Middle East. So we've been seeing for a long time rich Gulf countries going and trying to help Lebanon. When Lebanon gets stuck at its various power-sharing formulas, you have an intervention by a single Gulf country, Qatar, in most recent experience, but that is kind of a surrogate for the Gulf Cooperation Council. They find ways to allow one country that can write big checks to get out in front and to try to either adjudicate or pay off the bad actors. There are regional mechanisms that are very informal that do help pull individual countries or regional conflicts back from the brink. So we're seeing Qatar being in particular. But what I wanted to just leave as a last thought was, when do we move from management to solution? Management is sort of accepting that not all problems can be solved. But if we take the Syria case or the Libya case, they actually went all the way to changing the facts on the ground. This was not just tolerating an unstable situation and allowing it to continue. It was saying we've got to get to the finish line. So I'm interested in others' thoughts on how these informal arrangements can also become new tools for actually solving problems, not just managing them. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Ellen. And that was really a superb encapsulation of some of the themes in the book that deal with the Middle East and the Maghreb region. Over to you, Chantal.
Thank you, Fenn. As Fenn said, in this book, I've written the chapter on transatlantic relations, NATO, and the EU. And in the chapter, I make four main arguments. First is that when we look at the longer term, NATO is on a downward and at best a flat trajectory. And its main residual task is strategic reassurance. Europeans, I think, look to the U.S. and to NATO not as the immediate but as the ultimate guarantor of security, and hence the title of the chapter, Play It Again, Uncle Sam. Second, the EU, again, when looking at the longer term, is on an upward trajectory and should ultimately, I think, be able to take care of its own security and hopefully be a more effective global actor in the international system, including in conflict management. Third, I think as Europeans develop a strategic sense of self, and as time goes by, Europeans, I think, will feel less need for strategic reassurance. And fourth, despite the demise of NATO or its flat trajectory, transatlantic relations, that is, relations between the U.S. and Europe, remain a major potential force for peace and security in the 21st century. We remain each other's best allies. And I would say there are four reasons for that. First of all, we share overall strategic objectives. We all believe in market economy, in democracy, and respect for human rights. Second, I think we're basically in agreement about the nature of the threat to the international system. We all agree that proliferation is a big problem. We all agree that terrorism is a big problem, and we all have great concerns about the Middle East. Third, we have actually a very good track record in cooperating with each other. And when Europe and the U.S. work together, they are a real force to be reckoned with. And finally, I would say because U.S. and Europe are the main development donors and humanitarian donors, we have similar interest in that these donor monies are being spent wisely, and I would say particularly in this fiscal environment. That said, I think the transatlantic relationship is not without its challenges, and I see basically five challenges, three that are shared and two that are specific to either Europe or the U.S. In terms of the shared challenges, I think we both have publics that are disengaged when it comes to foreign affairs and conflict management. Second, we both feel very strong fiscal pressures. Third, the asymmetrical military capabilities is a real problem for this relationship, and I think Libya was, again, a good example. Europe continues to spend its defense euros in a not very smart way, I would say. In terms of this specific challenge, there is the fact that Europe is politically divided. And again, I think Libya was a good example. But it's also interesting to see in the case of Libya that the political divisions within Europe are shifting and are no longer so starkly between old and new Europe. It seems to me that that division is actually becoming less important. Now, the other challenge that we face, and that's a challenge that we see here on this side of the Atlantic, is that there's lots of disinterest and skepticism, and even, one could say, a loss of confidence with regard to Europe's willingness and capacity to be a global actor. And I think the U.S. will walk away from this relationship if it thinks that Europeans are more of a burden than a resource or a partner. So those are my main arguments. I think my two most controversial arguments have to do with the way I view NATO on the one hand and the EU on the other. So let me start and say a few words about NATO, and then I'll say a few words about the EU. Let me start with NATO. Last November, that was in November 2010, NATO summit meeting in Lisbon adopted a new strategic concept. And this new strategic concept really tried to bridge the different positions within NATO and overcome some of the tensions that had arisen over Afghanistan. In NATO speak, one tried to bridge NATO in-area responsibilities and missions and NATO out-of-area activities. There was also, I think, great hope that this summit could rekindle some of the public support for NATO. Among and in NATO member states. I think, unfortunately, the summit came and went and didn't really have the kind of impact that some people had hoped for, nor did it really manage to overcome the division between minimalist and maximalist. That is, minimalist, those who favor that NATO concentrates on its core mission, that is, collective self-defense, and those who have a broader view of NATO and who would like NATO to be engaged in a broader range of activities and engage in global partnerships. And then Libya comes along. Now, for some, Libya has become proof for NATO's relevance. In NATO circles, in Brussels, people say, but look, we took this decision really rapidly, despite some initial dissent. Look how fantastic. This time it was not the U.S. who led in front, but was leading from the back. They all point to the number of sorties that were made with planes by the French and the Brits. And Phil Gordon, the U.S. Assistant Secretary for Europe, has even talked about a new model of intervention. Now, I would argue that NATO was actually very lucky by the way things turned out. Libya almost made us forget the enormous difficulties we faced and still face in Afghanistan in terms of political will and remember the national caveats and in terms of capabilities. And I don't think that the Libya operation is really a new model for intervention. If anything, I think it underscored the fundamental weakness of NATO, which were also outlined in very striking manner by the U.S., the outgoing U.S. Secretary of Defense, Bob Gates, in June 2011. And those weaknesses have to do, on the one hand, with the huge asymmetry in force capabilities, and second, with the fact that member states are politically divided. Now, I think the Libya intervention was a perfect example of what Pamela and Fenn and Chet call CCM. Because here, indeed, we have NATO being joined by the Arab League, NATO being joined by non-NATO European members like Sweden, NATO being joined by non-NATO members of the Arab world like Qatar and others. But as I said before, I think this development of the CCM is actually very bad news for NATO. And there is this paradox that the more NATO engages in these type of activities with a multitude of actors, the more it engages in global partnerships, the more difficult it will be for the organization to remain a coherent and strong organization. I think the NATO à la carte model is not a model for a strong organization. And that is why I argue that NATO is on a downward and at best a flat trajectory. So let me say a few words about the EU. Today, when we open a newspaper, it is all gloom and doom when it comes to the EU. Now, I have to admit, I'm not an economist, but I do recognize that the economic crisis is serious. But I also believe, as many economics experts tell us, that at heart this crisis is really not an economic crisis, but a political crisis. So if we look at the fundamentals and take Europe as a whole, the economic situation is actually not that bad. Europe, unlike the US, doesn't have a huge deficit. Europe doesn't need to underwrite its debt by some outside power, like, for instance, China. It actually has sufficient resources to deal with the problem. Most economists think that there is actually a solution to this problem, maybe not a great solution, but there is a solution, and that is the issuance of some sort of Eurobond by the European Central Bank. And some EU countries, even those not in the Eurozone, are even prepared to help shoulder the burden in this regard. I think the reason why Germany and Angela Merkel have been so hesitant to go this road has to do with the moral hazard issue. That is, how can we make sure that those who we will bail out will actually put their economic house in order? And in the end, I think this is all a question about trust and confidence. Now, the EU summit meeting next week in December 8 and 9 will be a very important meeting, and it is expected that we will see some forward movement and maybe some actual decisions. I'm actually kind of optimistic in this regard, because if you look again at the different projections, a collapse of the euro is going to be very costly for everybody, including the Germans. I've seen some calculations that showed that the currency union has created huge profits for Germany, amounting in the last 2 years of somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 to 60 billion euros. And if Germany would leave the euro, these profits would quickly disappear. Quitting the eurozone, reintroducing a mark would actually lead to a reevaluation of the currency, some say by some 40%, and that would make exports then more expensive, even prohibitive, and might even lead to a sort of total collapse of the German exports. Having Germany quit the eurozone, there have been other calculations that say might cost Germans up to 10 to 14% of its gross domestic product. And some have even put that for the first year at 20 to 25% of its gross domestic product. So these are huge costs. And I think if you look at the comparisons where Germany would be prepared to give some of the troubled countries in the Union a sort of haircut in terms of their debt, the calculations are that the cost would be much lower. And then I'm not even talking about, you know, the political implications of a collapse of the eurozone. And I would urge you all to read the speech of Radek Sikorski, the Polish foreign minister in Germany, where he said, and this is from the Polish foreign minister, "I fear German power less than I'm beginning to fear German inaction." Germany has become Europe's indispensable nation. And Sikorski goes on and says, "You may not fail to lead." I think this has been an enormous statement from a Polish foreign minister. So given these realities, I'm actually quite optimistic that we can turn this crisis into an opportunity. I do think we are obliged to go into greater integration, and hopefully that will happen in during the summit. Now, in terms of conflict management, this is, of course, not great news.
Thank you, Chantal. If I were to summarize your comments, it would be it's not okay to be Cartesian when it comes to security, but it's okay to muddle through when it comes to economics. Over to you, Paul.
Thanks very much. Fenya, as you already heard, my role in this was to co-author one of the chapters, which was meant to provide a sort of bird's eye view, if you like, of the state of regionalism and what exactly has been going on in terms of this regional rewiring. And it was co-authored with Jürgen Harker at the London School of Economics. And what I want to do today, is, as I've been asked to do, is basically address very briefly three main questions. Number one is, if we look at the world of regional arrangements out there, and depending how you count them, there's at least 30 regional arrangements out there in the world that have some sort of security provisions built into their conventions, charters, and other remits now. And how exactly, what are the ways in which they've differed in their approaches to conflict management? So that's the first thing I want to talk about. The second thing then is, well, what explains this different regional approaches across the world? What, at least of the academic literature and theoretical literature, got to bring to bear about understanding why ASEAN behaves so differently from NATO and the EU behaves so differently from the Arab League or the African Union? So that's the second question. And then thirdly, as Fenn mentioned, I was asked to say something brief about the sort of key security challenges in the African region at the moment. And if you're not already depressed by my overview of the regional arrangements, you will be depressed by my assessment of the security challenges facing Africa, because I think on almost every dimension or criteria you care to measure them, that part of the world is facing some of the most serious problems. So that's the plan. So in terms of the first issue about what are the different dimensions of regional variation you find out there with regard to conflict management, as I said, it varies slightly depending how you count them, but about 30 regional arrangements explicitly claim to be interested in security practices, and most of those claim to be interested in conflict management of one sort or another. But how do they go about that? It varies really quite dramatically depending where you look. The first dimension is really just how much significance does an arrangement actually afford issues of conflict management. And here you have a huge spectrum. For some, it's a fundamental priority. You know, for the European Union, for example, stopping war between its member states was ultimately the fundamental rationale. The African Union more recently has fostering cooperation and resolving conflict as one of its core sets of principles. But for other regional arrangements, conflict resolution and management is really much more of a sideshow and much further down the list. The former British Commonwealth, for one, the Organization of Islamic Conference, or the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, for example, conflict resolution is not a big part of their agendas. The second key dimension that you see that varies out there, it's really the where in the conflict cycle, on the broad spectrum of conflict management, where do regional arrangements focus? And here you again see a broad spectrum from sort of those organizations that focus primarily on sort of upstream conflict prevention, as Alvaro was mentioning earlier today, put in sort of Boutros-Ghali's terminology. Organizations like the OSCE, for example, are much more concerned with the sort of upstream conflict prevention and at the other end of the spectrum, peace-building agenda. Others are much more into the peacekeeping or mediation areas of the cycle. A third, and I suppose one of the most obvious ways in which these arrangements differ, is that they have hugely varying institutional frameworks for making decisions, deciding what techniques and instruments to use in relation to conflict. Now, some of them, it's tricky, some of them have institutions that only exist on paper and have never been utilized in practice at all. Also, when it comes to decision-making, the vast majority of these remain at the intergovernmental level. We haven't gone all the way to sort of supranational decision-making and sources of authority here. And when it comes to decision-making procedures, probably the most common variant out there is some form of consensus decision-making. But that's, we should say very clearly, consensus is not the same as unanimity in the sense that, for example, the European Union's common foreign and security policy requires. Consensus doesn't need every member state to stick their hand up and vote yes for a particular course of action. It just requires members who vote against or would like to go against that course of action to keep quiet publicly and assume at least a degree of collective responsibility. But I think one of the most interesting trends we've seen recently is a growing trend towards the delegation of decision-making structures. And what I'm getting at here is where a small subset of a membership of a regional arrangement is really given the reins to control conflict management and peace and security issues. So a couple of key examples in the African continent would be, you know, ECOWAS in West Africa, 15 members, but all the key decisions on peace and security and conflict management are taken by a mediation and security council, which can meet with a quorum of just five, so a third of the membership. The same with the African Union, which is now, with South Sudan, up to 54 members. All the key decisions about conflict management are taken by the Peace and Security Council, which has a membership of just 15. So I think across the various parts of the world, you can see very different approaches to decision-making. Also, you'll see a big difference in how much I think they trust and fund their bureaucrats and their secretariats. You have huge variation in terms of the money that is put in by these arrangements to actually set up a functioning secretariat and bureaucracy. If you look at the sort of large end of the spectrum in the European Union and NATO, as we've heard, you'll see tens of thousands of officials and bureaucrats helping to oil that organization. At the other end of the spectrum, you'll find organizations like the Intergovernmental Authority on Development for the Horn of Africa, where if you get a dozen officials involved in everything, you're lucky. And it will vary dramatically sometimes from year to year. There's also great variation in how much, as I said, the member states will trust their secretariats to play a leading or proactive role. And again, in some organizations, being the Secretary General or some of the senior bureaucratic positions actually lead to quite a large degree of autonomy for decision making and room for maneuver. In others, it's very much these are secretaries first and generals most definitely last, and they are to follow precisely the orders of the member states. And so some keep their secretariats very famished and on a tight leash, and others far more autonomy is given. It's also important to say that a lot of regional arrangements break their own rules on a fairly regular basis. Now, when the Security Council at the UN has issues, of course, this is under the media spotlight. But when ECOWAS doesn't quite conform to its decision-making procedures, it doesn't normally generate the same degree of media attention. And that leads me to my fourth dimension of difference, is to do with the techniques and the instruments that these regional arrangements actually use for conflict management. Some of them will only act with either their own members or coalitions of their memberships. Others will actually actively invite external actors to come in and engage with an issue either with a subset of the membership or on their own. Also, there's a huge variation in terms of how they think about mediation and negotiation. Now, it's fair to say, I think, that pretty much every organization at some point will support mediation and negotiation as a response to conflict management, but they have very different ideas of whether this should be done bilaterally between members of the group, whether it should be done on a collective basis, as we heard earlier, whether it should be done in terms of multiple forums on offer at the same time or not. There's also huge difference when it comes to collective action involving any military or policing capacities. some regional arrangements, the European Union and African Union spring to mind most commonly, engage regularly in collective forms of peacekeeping operations. Other organizations, ASEAN would spring to mind here, will not at all engage in the collective use of military force for peacekeeping. Another big debate here is obviously where the use of force and coercive sanctions fit in. Some organizations like the Organization of American States, or again ASEAN would be an example, will really shy away from coercive mechanisms of military force to deal with conflicts. On the other hand, the European Union, NATO, and the African Union are quite ready to impose both coercive diplomatic and economic sanctions and also impose military sanctions, as we've seen. And then the final area or dimension of variation that we highlight in the chapter is about geographic scope. Now, virtually all of these regional arrangements generally confine their activities to within their own neighbourhoods, and they engage in conflict management issues in area, as it were. The two big and important exceptions are NATO and the European Union, which really, the way they think about security and conflict issues, define them almost by definition as things that happen in other people's neighbourhoods, and hence it's the EU and NATO that we've seen operate out of area most frequently. So if those are the different ways that regional arrangements have varied on these issues, what actually explains what's going on? And I think the short answer, and this would probably, I suppose, bolster Chet's analogy that this is a really sort of organic and uncontrolled or unorchestrated process, is that I don't think anyone really has a clear explanation to explain all these differences. But what you do find are sort of four key clusters of explanations out there in the literature. Cluster number one says really this is all about political power. And the way we can explain what regional arrangements are doing fundamentally is about the big boys' rules and the rest have to follow on. And so you get lots of literature talking about the role of hegemons, and they come in two varieties, really. External hegemons that sort of overlay and penetrate an organisation, and obviously the United States' role globally is crucial here. But also then internal hegemons. What role, for example, will Nigeria have in shaping the way ECOWAS deals with issues? What role will Russia play in shaping the way the Commonwealth of Independent States reacts, and et cetera, et cetera? So political power is sort of cluster number one. Cluster number two you'll find out there is that it's really all to do with domestic politics. You can really understand the behaviour of regional arrangements if you understand what type of states are creating them in the first place. And here you have, broadly speaking, explanations that will say if you find broadly liberal-minded, cosmopolitan, multilateralist and internationalist states like the European Union, it's not surprising you'll find them trying to export their projects elsewhere. If, however, you find organisations comprised mainly of authoritarian, weak and largely illegitimate regimes who are targeting large segments of their own population, it's not surprising they might build regional arrangements that tend to protect their sovereignty and tend to protect regime security rather than promote more human variants. And then the third factor, and we heard a little bit from Ellen already about security cultures. A third cluster would say actually it's the norms and cultural assumptions and predispositions which really matter. If you go to different parts of the world, you know, you understand culture really does matter. People think about things in different ways. They prioritize things in different ways. They construct threat agendas, and crucially, they construct problems to be solved and solutions in very different ways. And so there's a group of literature out there that talks about what are the sort of shared dispositions that regional arrangements hold towards dealing with conflict. And here it will sort of highlight for some regional arrangements, literally certain things are considered illegitimate or ineffective or implausible, whereas other options are then enabled and put on the table because of their deeper cultural assumptions. And then the fourth and final cluster that we talk about is to do with the extent of collective capabilities. And this really, I suppose, goes back to a bit the sort of material sense in which we're talking about budgets here. If you want to actually do something in a collective sense in conflict management, it's very hard to do something and act as an actor without capabilities. Now, whether this is a bunch of trained mediators, whether it's battalions of trained peacekeepers, the ability to run a sanctions committee, whatever it might entail, without some collective material capabilities, it's very difficult for an organisation as such to do things in the organisation's name. And obviously, most of the regional arrangements out there in the world do not have a great deal of collective capabilities, but they still farm these out to the member states on a regular basis. But this explanation would say, well, it's not surprising organizations like NATO and the European Union do most in the way of conflict management because they have the most ability and collective capabilities to do that. It's very hard for an organization like the African Union, for example, even if it wants to get involved in peacekeeping in Sudan or Somalia or wherever else, if it doesn't have the collective capabilities to do that, it makes things very difficult. So that's, I would say, the sort of, I don't want to adjudicate between the four, and probably there's all four of these things going on in very complicated ways, but that seemed to us to be the sort of most common clusters of approaches to explaining these regional variants. So finally, to Africa, and very quickly, and obviously we could go on for a long time about this, but what are some of the key security challenges Africa's facing? I think four in the immediate term spring to mind. Armed conflict and warfare is obviously most people's top of the agenda, but it's the intrastate, internal, and non-state variety that's been most important recently. Number two, state weakness, state fragility, state failure, state collapse, depending which label you prefer. But regimes which either struggle to control their territory and populations or regimes which actively target certain segments of their populations have been a huge security issue and remain so. As the authors of the Africa chapters in the book point out, transnational organized criminal activity is also an increasingly important issue. And one of the chapters in the book talks about how West Africa is becoming the sort of cocaine coast, as Sven mentioned, as the transit route for a lot of drug shipments from the Caribbean into Europe. But also other criminal activities, whether it's smuggling humans or smuggling small arms and light weapons, are an increasingly important part of the agenda. And then number four, if we think in human security terms, it's still public health issues, which are far and away the key problem facing African people, HIV/AIDS, malaria, and TB, the sort of the big three. Looking to the future, and while trying not to be depressing, but it gets hard not to be at one level, two big known unknowns, if you like, on the horizon of African security would be, number one, how is the continent going to deal with an increasing population, an increasingly youthful population, and an increasingly urbanizing population? And those three segments of a growing Africa, a more youthful Africa, and a rapidly urbanizing Africa are going to pose huge security challenges in the future. And then the second big known unknown are the impacts of climate change, which we don't clearly understand fully what is happening or the causal mechanisms, but at parts of sub-Saharan Africa, in terms of water scarcity, deforestation, shrinking rangeland, desertification, and big challenges that flow for food security is going to be a huge part of the agenda. How have Africa's regional arrangements coped? The short answer is not very well. They're struggling would be an understatement, and this is for a number of reasons. They generally lack shared analysis of the challenges and problems. They hence lack a shared understanding of the potential solutions. The burden of response has been shared very unevenly amongst a few key member states, and there's been a lot of sort of free riding going on. But I would point arguably to one of the main problems has been this consensual style of decision making. And if I finish with just a quick rundown on the African Union's Peace and Security Council for the last 2 years, five of its 15 members have been the following. You had Robert Mugabe's Zimbabwe, Muammar Gaddafi's Libya, Laurent Gbagbo's Cote d'Ivoire, Mr. Deby's Chad, and Mr. Nguema's Equatorial Guinea. Those are a third of the members of the Peace and Security Council who we had to come to a consensus with to do anything in relation to conflict management, and that is a depressing thought.
Thanks very much. You've been a very patient audience, and we do have to wrap this up at 12. So I'd invite a number of questions from the audience. If you want to direct them to one particular panelist, please say so, and please identify yourselves. So, yes, sir.
Sorry, I did not want to monopolize the conversation. I was holding back. Professor Williams, again, Rob Dubois for DepSecDef's Senior Integration Group. You mentioned those five stellar specimens of humanity. This is such a delicate conversation. They didn't get in power by themselves. Many of the states that are struggling to deal with them now have been involved in past decades with helping them build security for themselves and their regimes. Is transparency accountability and a forthright approach from some of our states, our position is going to be useful, or is it going to be undermining us and be counter?
I think it would depend on a number of factors. One would be the sort of timetable or timescale you're looking at this in, and what can feel like a painful relationship in the short term might get less painful in the long term as we more come to agree. But I think this really goes back to the big issues that were raised in the first panel about how the Security Council in particular is thinking about sovereignty. And what are the sort of obligations that we think sovereigns have to live up to? What are the sort of conditions we as a world are going to impose on sovereign rulers? I mean, we've really traditionally laid the sort of threshold very low in the sense that we've said as long as you don't invade neighbouring country or any other countries, and as long as you don't commit sort of genocidal violence on your own population, sovereignty has given you a pretty clear leeway to do quite a lot in between those two things. But as we've seen recently in, you know, the Security Council's resolution 1973 on Libya sort of is a political turning point in that sense, we're getting increasingly pushy about what conditions and what obligations sovereign leaders have to live up to. President Bashir finds himself, you know, the unlucky dictator in one sense as being the first sitting president indicted by an international criminal court now. So I think in the short term, it's going to be a period of very big normative turbulence as we decide exactly what sovereignty means and exactly what responsibilities outsiders should be playing when faced with regimes like that. So in the short term, I don't see anything other than turbulence. But in the longer term, hopefully it might lead to a bit more of a stable international society.
Yes, sir.
Hi, Ted Morrow, ED101, a private consultant. I was going to ask Ms. Otterott to talk about NATO expansion, and I'm thinking particularly of the impacts it's made in the Caucasus regions. Would you comment a little on how you see the future of NATO expansion, and if you've seen it as both a destabilizing and a stabilizing factor in European issues?
Yeah, I mean, personally, I think actually NATO expansion, we've sort of gone as far as we could, and I don't foresee any further expansion, formal expansion of NATO membership to Ukraine or other countries in that region. And personally, I'm not so sure that would be a right way for NATO to go. The only way that could work is if NATO has Russia on board with these type of issues, and that is not the case. And on the contrary, the Russians have been launching some sort of counter-regional type of organizations with the Eurasian new association of states. And so I don't think that in this particular climate there's going to be more expansion. And then, you know, financially, I think it's just not, it's not in the cards, I think.
Pamela?
Thank you. Pamela All, one of the editors. And this has been a really interesting panel, and thank you for going beyond your own chapters and really reflecting on the regions as a whole. I'd like to tie this panel to the first panel and to ask each of you to give us your thoughts about how the regions see global security, their role in global security, and whether there's any, there's a movement from the regions to strengthen the UN or to strengthen some sort of higher collectivity in terms of security.
Well, I'll give it a try. I think for most of the countries of the Middle East, they are going to be, for the short to medium term, very much preoccupied with their own situations, and they have been underperformers for the most part in kind of global governance mechanisms. A few important exceptions would be Egypt, for example, I think has played a very strong role in UN endeavors, including its promotion of the non-proliferation treaties call for a weapons of mass destruction free zone in the Middle East. So they were a driver of something that started at the global level that has a regional application. So, you know, Egyptian diplomacy, I would say, stands out as one of the actors that cares at the global level and is an important player at the global level. A few small examples of, you know, I mentioned before the UAE now contributes on a regular basis health units to UN peacekeeping, but relatively modest regional performance overall. The Moroccans have contributed troops to UN peacekeeping over the years. But what I'm struck with by both the Libya and the Syria situations is the creeping sort of absorption of the new norms about responsibility to protect, for example. I see the Arabs somewhat reluctantly and not very explicitly absorbing some of these new ideas and feeling that they, and this is very much outside the authoritarian culture, where the Middle East put up very strong kind of national boundaries and said, back off, international community. You know, we're going to decide for ourselves. That's all shifting. So, you know, we may see them become more comfortable. The Middle East countries, Arabs have been outliers in, you know, UN human rights fora. They've been very conflicted. And Iran is a fascinating case of a country that, because of its revolutionary fervor, isn't sure it really trusts the international system. I mean, it looks at the UN as these were structures that were created by, you know, the good old boys network that won World War II, and we're not part of that. So there is still a kind of questioning and a kind of undertow saying, these aren't our institutions. These are what the old colonial powers think is important. And yet they don't really know how to offer an alternative. So there are, you know, little pulls and pushes in a few different directions, but I think it may be shifting slightly in the direction of wanting to be more active mainstream contributors to international security.
Yeah, I think in terms of Europe, I mean, currently there's a very strong inward-looking tendency in Europe. You know, the fiscal crisis, the euro crisis is not helping in that regard. That said, I think Europeans are faced with a more assertive Russia. They are faced with global problems relating to proliferation, counterterrorism, energy security, the Middle East. I mean, it's next door. And so they will have to act in one way or another. And I think at the political elite level, there is a willingness to do that. And I think if we manage to move forward towards more integration, European Union actually will become a global actor. I think the question here is whether Europe will play together with the U.S., yes or no. And I think ultimately, I think there I'm also quite optimistic for the reasons I outlined before. But there is a danger that, you know, Europeans will just not move forward. And I think at that time, the U.S. will walk away from the transatlantic relationship. And, you know, that might lead to all sorts of other rifts. One more maybe a thing to add is your whole notion of CCM. I was thinking it's actually quite interesting that these ad hoc, a la carte type of coalitions, it's actually great for weak organizations or weak institutional structures. And I think it works very well in the Middle East. And to some extent, it works very well for Europe, who is weak on the security side. I mean, there it hasn't developed its institutional framework. So for Europe, this might actually be a chance and might move it forward. But for organizations like the UN or NATO, this is a real disaster and is actually very bad news.
With regards to Africa, I mean, Africa doesn't have any global powers, I suppose, despite sometimes the rhetoric from South Africa and Nigeria, but they don't have any global powers and they're not likely to anytime soon. But the African Union and most of its members are still also very inward-looking. There's enough problems on their plate to cope within the continent. But I do think where they are looking for a more global role is they have definitely been trying to seek to redefine their relationship with the UN Security Council over the last few years, partly through pushing quite hard, I think, on what exactly does Chapter 8 of the UN Charter mean in practical terms when it comes to issues of conflict management. You've seen members of the African Union's Peace and Security Council trying to hold joint meetings with the UN Security Council. There's been shared training of the personnel, and it's led to a stage where I think you've seen some pushback from the members of the UN Security Council, who have reiterated quite strongly sometimes that there's still a clear hierarchy here. The UN Security Council holds the primary position, and you are still a regional arrangement. And that's led, I think, sort of a couple of problems with the AU's agenda. Number one is in the terms that Alvaro put it earlier this morning. They've been focused, I think, a bit more on the short-term minutiae of Security Council reform and which African countries might get a seat in an expanded council. They've not really been focused or particularly vocal about what is the political direction we want this organization to go more broadly, what are the political values we support to drive that. And secondly, the problem that Chet pointed out earlier is that the irony here is that from the African Union side, they definitely want to exert more control about what's done in conflict management terms on the continent, but they lack any serious capabilities beyond mediation, really. They lack any serious capabilities on the peacekeeping side of the equation, and so that puts them in a difficult situation, I think.
The very back of the room.
Thank you. Alexis Lovey, recent graduate from University College London. One of the greatest security challenges that you've all mentioned is transnational crime. And of course, this is non-state actors at a transnational level. We cannot have one institution really look at it. What would you, this can be to anyone in particular, both a management and policy, where should it come from, both at a state level, local, international, or, and should it present itself in a development manner or security manner or perhaps a hybrid?
Who'd like to take that one on?
I'll take a quick step at it. I think actually the European Union is doing a pretty good job on this matter because it basically has to do with police, border controls, and the European Union has been doing a lot of training in this regard. Now, it's not totally successful because we have a lot of problems, particularly in the Balkans, but I think it is looking at those type of training of police and border guards and customs officials.
Okay. Just to add one thing, because one of the chapters in the book on Africa in particular highlights this as a real problem for West Africa, and ECOWAS, the regional arrangement there, has been really struggling. And I would just use that as a case study to, in terms of your levels, really reiterate the importance of the local. And the reason why is because, just at a very basic level, definitions of what counts as illegal and criminal activity doesn't always necessarily gel with local perceptions of what is illegitimate behavior. And as the book talks about in relation to whether it's some of the sort of cyber crime scams, 419 scams in Nigeria, or drug trafficking through West Africa as well, a lot of locals will generally see this as another commodity to be traded. What's wrong with this? Consenting adult sort of views of these things. Whereas this runs up very quickly, obviously, against, well, this is illegal activity, this is contraband in other parts of the world. So I think unless you really address the local perceptions of what really, or where do you draw the line between criminal and licit behavior, you're going to have a very difficult job of imposing or enforcing any regime.
Chet, you get the last question.
Thanks. Actually, several questions. We have a moderator from Canada, and I wonder how all this looks from a Canadian perspective. So perhaps you could say something about the way CCM and other issues we've been talking about appear from Ottawa. Next question I had is, Chantal, you said that the Libyan intervention might not be a model for intervention. When that term was used by a senior State Department official, I think what was being referenced was the idea that the U.S. didn't have to be out in front on everything. And I wonder if you could expand on that and whether or not one gets more leverage by sometimes giving other organizations the credit or giving other actors the credit or saying that we'll be part of it but we're not going to run everything. Is that part of CCM or is that just the current administration's fashion du jour? I mean, how do you see that? Others may want to comment on that issue too. And then finally, who are going to be the key shapers of Middle Eastern security going forward? I'd address you, Ellen, on this. The dominant players in the Middle East historically are in difficult shape right now. Israel's in difficult shape. Iraq's in difficult shape. Syria's going down the tubes, and Egypt is so internally focused that it can't really play an external role. So does this leave the Middle East in the hands of the Turks and the Saudis, or how's that going to shake out?
I'll go first on the whole notion of this is a new intervention because the U.S. was leading from the back. Well, actually, if you look at it, it wasn't really. If it wasn't for the U.S. cruise missiles in the beginning, this operation would have never gone off on the start that it had. Very quickly, we realized that we didn't have the targeting specialist in the center in Italy, and so the U.S. had to rush a number of these specialists to Europe. And then very quickly, the Europeans ran out of ammunition. So, you know, if that's the new model, I'm not so sure.
Well, your Middle East question allows me to just add a point that we didn't quite get to, which is, you know, the shifting geopolitics and the, you know, where when the dust settles, if it settles, you know, who will be the new power centers. You could certainly argue that the Saudis and the GCC are more intact than any other part of the region, holding on to the status quo that they like. And they have a real external threat that helps organize them, which is Iran. And they've already decided who their security partner is. It's us. So in a way, there is a kind of stability or continuity for that part of the region, which is security partnership with the U.S., facing the Iranian threat, and so far a consensus among the GCC members that, for example, what the Saudis wanted to have happen in Bahrain became the consensus policy. But we do still see, let's be honest, you know, Bahrain, even Kuwait, there's a little Arab Spring happening in a different way in the Gulf, and it's that story isn't necessarily over. But I don't think anybody would predict that the Saudis are facing the kind of systemic instability that some of the other large states are. But I do expect that Egypt will come back, and the Egyptian military, even if they get do step back from domestic politics, which I still think is their preference, Egypt will want to resume, you know, play a little bit more of an important regional role. So if we look at the kind of take Syria, assume that Syria is in some kind of a long transition for many years, we've still got Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and Iraq. Iraq was once a very strong pillar of the Arab state system. But these countries don't trust each other. I mean, Saudi, Iraq, Egypt, almost every one of those bilateral relationships is quite troubled. So these are three separate power centers that are not necessarily coordinating. Most intriguing is your reference to Turkey and Iran, and people do certainly see the Turks as playing, and nobody's quite figured out what the boundaries or limits of it are, but Turkey is certainly playing an exceptionally more powerful role in shaping regional politics in mostly a positive way, so far not a negative way. If they have to take sustained military action in northern Iraq vis-a-vis the Kurds, that will turn out to be a big problem, but so far it's been for short periods. But I do think this issue of the non-Arab actors having a kind of leadership role is one of the sources of turbulence and could be a motivator for the Arab state system to get its act together, which takes us back to the Arab League. Does the Arab League sort of reinvent itself, have a stronger security component? On the books in the Arab League charter from 1945 is language about security that has never been implemented. So in theory, they could try to assert a more dynamic role there.
It's not often that Canada gets the last word. Uh, in some ways, we were deficient in the book because the one region we left out was the Arctic, and that's probably my fault. And if I would say that there's a region that, as we look at some of the evolving economic and resource conflict challenges that are going to emerge in that region in the next 15 to 20 years, it's going to need CCM and it's going to need leadership. Leadership from both Canada and the United States. Historically, I would say, CCM is in Canadian DNA. We'd like to take credit for the fact that we invented peacekeeping, which wasn't in the UN Charter. That was perhaps the first CCM venture. More recently, the kind of role that Canada played in the landmines initiative, which was a CCM negotiation venture, the Ottawa process, which took those negotiations out of the Conference on Disarmament in Geneva. I would say if there's been a delta change in Canadian policy in the past 10 years, we've gone from the soft side of CCM to the hard side. You see that in the Canadian role in Afghanistan, including diplomacy that we've done on the AFPAC border and the Dubai process, which the conclusion to the book points out as an example of CCM. Chantal, in giving credit to all sorts of people in the Libya campaign, failed to mention that it was a Canadian general in NATO who was, leading the charge. The Canadian Navy has been very active in anti-piracy operations in that CCM venture off the Horn of Africa. And I think the whole orientation of the Harper Conservative government, which has announced a whole series of capital equipment campaigns for our military, which are probably the envy of the Pentagon right now, indicates that Canada is interested in both hard and soft CCM. And with that, I will ask Pamela to give the benediction, because she really has been the missing editor, co-editor up here on the panel, and I would just like to echo what Chet has said. We couldn't do these wonderful books, and it is a $1 million operation. The Institute has sold, I think, almost $1 million worth of copy in our various ventures. That money, by the way, does go back to the Institute. The editors don't get rich in this enterprise. But Pamela has really had the challenge of herding cats and finding the Canadian who's always missing in action in these ventures. So over to you, Pamela.
Great. Well, thank you very much. I want to thank the panelists, to thank our moderators, to thank all of you who sat through this morning, and to hope that this is the beginning of a very, very healthy dialogue between regional security people and conflict management people, because it hasn't really happened on that scale before. So we look forward to seeing you again soon, and thank you very much. Thank you.